Welcome to the 110th episode of Speaking of Mysteries. Our guest is Reese Bowen, who, because she obviously doesn't have enough to do with two ongoing series, Molly Murphy and Her Royal Spyness, adds In Farley Field, a standalone mystery, to her bibliography. In Farley Field takes place in what is described as England's darkest days during World War II. The time between the beginning of the war at the end of the summer of 1939 and the U.S.'s entry at the end of 1941. It's a time when the Brits were discouraged by the constant bombings and the catastrophic results of the Battle of Dunkirk, in which British troops were saved by a flotilla of volunteer fishermen. While it's a story with plenty of stiff upper lips and keep calm and carry on sensibilities, it has some mighty dark underpinnings that include the impact of fake news on an already demoralized population. Here's Reese Bowen. Welcome back to Speaking of Mysteries. This is Nancy Clare, and I am really delighted that we have Reese Bowen, whose most recent book, In Farley Field, has just been released. Welcome, Reese.
Thank you, Nancy. Hi.
Congratulations on the publication of In Farley Field. And I'm just wondering, because you have two mystery series ongoing, Her Royal Spyness and Molly Murphy, with the most recent of which, Time of Fog and Fire, was published earlier this week. How did you find time for a standalone?
I suppose the answer to that is I'm a crazy woman. This was a book I'd wanted to write for a long time, and so I made time for it. I got the idea for it way back in probably the year 2000, and I thought I'd like to write about a family rather like the Mitford sisters, a really eccentric aristocratic family in World War II, and each of them was doing a little bit towards the war effort, but nobody knew what anybody else was doing. And I thought this would be a fun thing to do. So I wrote some chapters, and I sent it to my, at that time, agent. And she looked at it, and she said, "Oh, nobody's interested in World War II," she said. And I think it's rather insulting and trite to have people having a good time in the English countryside when so much terrible was going on in Germany. So I put it aside. After that, I got rid of my agent, I have to say, and got a nice new one. But the story kept nagging at me, and I thought, you know, that really is a good story. I'd actually like to get to it. So when I thought I'd got enough, I'd established myself enough in the mystery field to write what I wanted to, then I went back to it and tried it again. And I showed it to my now agent, who, being brilliant, said, "Oh, I love this." So then I was encouraged to write more of it.
Well, it's interesting that your ex-agent said that. I mean, so much of mysteries are subjective. I find the period of World War II incredibly fascinating. And I also think there's been an increased interest in it. And my personal feeling is that's because it's beginning to fade out of the memory of living people. You know, those who were alive during the war are leaving us. And it makes it, I don't know, somehow it makes it more present. It makes it more immediate that we have to remember what happened.
I think that's true. I think also the other thing, too, is we're living in uncertain times, and we don't have a clear sense of good and evil, right and wrong at this moment. And, you know, we've had political upheavals, and we've had people quoting similarities to the time of World War II. I think people like to read about it because it was the last time we had this clear feeling of good versus evil. And everybody in England knew if they didn't do their part to stop it, it would swallow the world.
And, you know, I'm assuming that one of my questions is, you know, was there something in particular that drew you to set the story at the point in time between the start of the war, which was in Europe, was September 1939, and the U.S.'s entry at the very end of 1941. That was, you know, two-plus years that Europe was at war and the United States was not.
Yeah, and I think, well, the reason for setting it before America came into the war was these were the two worst years for England. London was being bombed every night. Other cities were being bombed. And, you know, at the end of 1940, we had Dunkirk and the British Army being stranded on the beaches and being rescued by little tiny boats across the Channel. And it was a really heroic time. But Germany was actually poised on the other side of 20 miles of English Channel. And I think the time I'm writing about, a lot of people thought the invasion really was imminent. And a lot of people thought England couldn't possibly win. So I think, you know, when the moment the U.S. came into the war, there was a tremendous sigh of relief and optimism that now we had the weapons and we had the fighting strength that maybe we could win. So I think you're seeing England at a time when there was a lot of despair and a lot of real worry that any moment now the Germans would come across the Channel. Luckily, Hitler was a madman, as you know, and he suddenly decided he was going to attack Russia instead. So Britain was spared. But if he'd wanted to take Britain at that time, he could have done so.
The location of the story is the south of England, which, of course, would have been the first place the Germans would have invaded as they yeah. came ashore on the south. But the other thing I found interesting was I'd read the book about the Mitford sisters, and then I also read I can't remember who wrote the book called The Four Princes. As you said, it was a very, very dark time, and so some people were probably, as you have in your book, are just going, well, you know, just let them come. Let's make the best possible deal we can and get on with our lives.
I think what the people, and especially the aristocrats, who actually had much more connection with Germany than the ordinary people who, you know, had no connection with Germany at all. I think the theory was, we are being bombed every night. They are flattening our most beautiful monuments, etc. If we make peace now, England will be spared. I think that's what they thought. I think those people thought, we can't possibly win. Why do we want our whole country to be ruined? And the other thing they thought was, Hitler likes England, you know. These are fellow Aryans. They're fellow Anglo-Saxons. We can, you know, he thought he could work with England because they were so similar. They were fellow Aryan people, a fine race, you know. And so I think people thought, well, if we made a good peace, Hitler would be nice to us. We'd get along well. Of course, that was completely naive thinking. England would have been a puppet state like all the other puppet states. And obviously the big fear was that he'd bring back the abdicated King Edward VIII and put him on the throne, because it was well known he was a huge admirer of Hitler. And so I think that's why they shipped him to the Bahamas, where American submarines could patrol very nicely and stop him from being rescued.
In the acknowledgments, you say that while you created Farley Place, which is the home of Lady Pamela, her sisters, and her parents, much of the underpinnings of the story was factual. You said you got the idea and you started to pull chapters together, but when you really got down to the nitty-gritty, how did you do the research? Did you read newspapers? Did you speak to people who were alive during the time? Because it's obviously true. Many of the factual part of it, this really happened.
Yeah. My research was multi-pronged. I read quite a few books, first-person accounts on working at Bletchley Park, on working for MI5. I read diaries that ordinary housewives kept during the war. I read, books Winston Churchill wrote on the war. So I read a good overview of background reading. Of course, you know, I was a child in that time right after the war. So obviously I was very aware of my family. My father came home. He'd been in North Africa for 4 years. I remember the family speaking about, you know, the day the bomb came and all these sort of things. And, of course, England in those post-war years was still on rationing, very heavily rationed, and it was a very bleak time in England. England had, they'd kept fighting from 39 to 45, and by 45 everybody was really tired, and you still couldn't get new clothes, you still couldn't get new furniture, you still couldn't get the sort of meat you wanted to eat. It was, and of course every time you went out you passed bomb sites. People had been relocated in horrible little prefab houses. And I think everybody was just really worn down after the war. So I had a lot of first-person feeling. Then, of course, I went over to England before I wrote the majority of the book. I spent a couple of days at Bletchley Park. I got the good feel for what it was like to be working in those huts. I went to the Imperial War Museum, and they had an exhibit of the home front during World War II, and you saw what an ordinary living room was like with the blackout curtains and the gas masks hanging up. You weren't allowed to go anywhere without your gas mask during the war. You know, things like that really make a big impression on you. And so I've got a ration book. I've got the little book they gave out called Make Do and Mend on how you were supposed to take old clothes and use them to make new clothes, because you couldn't buy new clothes. And if you got too fat, how you were supposed to let out your dresses. And, you know, all that sort of thing gives you a really good feeling for being there.
As you said, you started this book right around 2000, and I have to believe that you started to write it in earnest probably in 2014 or maybe 2015. And so books take a long time to write. So I find it's really prescient of you to include the fact that fake news from media outlets that sound like they should be legit is nothing new.
Quite true. No, the Germans use propaganda incredibly well, and I expect the British did too, I think. But so there were several German news channels, fake news channels, that were broadcast to England all the time. And they had British newsreaders and British announcers who'd turned traitor and gone to Germany. And, in those old radios, you turned the dial till you picked up a station. And you can imagine someone twiddling their dial, and they suddenly hear, and this is the news at 6 o'clock. And you think, oh, I found the news, good. And then it says, you know, so many ships have been sunk, and the British Navy is now in complete disarray. It was designed to create a feeling of despair among the British. It was very cleverly done.
And it seemed, at least in the storyline of your book, to have worked, although it was also one of the ways that the Germans contacted their agents in England through coded messages. And we won't say any more because that would be a spoiler. But it's something that the Brits were well aware of, but it was a real conundrum. And it was one of the things that the women and men at Bletchley Park were working on.
Yes. And, of course, the British did the same. They sent out coded messages to their operatives who were working undercover in France and in Germany, so that they, you know, they also got the coded messages. Everybody used this sort of thing. And, of course, the main work at Bletchley Park was to decode the messages the Germans sending on their Enigma machine. You know, they had this typewriter that was, as you typed a message, it randomly chose letters. And so you really had no way of decoding it. For years, they couldn't decode it. And then someone brilliant at Bletchley Park came up with a way of, every message started with a weather report. So once they knew that, they could decode the first bit for the day. And then they put it in this big, very, very primitive computer. And then it would decode the message for the day. So once they'd broken the way the Germans did the Enigma messages, they could get through and they'd pick up the messages that would say that such and such U-boat squad was about to attack a convoy, and they could warn that convoy. And so, you know, that was the big work of Bletchley Park. But these decoders were working on all sorts of German codes all the time.
And many of them were women, and that brings us to one of your main characters, Lady Pamela Sutton, known as Pama.
Yeah.
And I found it interesting that suspense and intrigue, you know, real and imagined, were everywhere, as you mentioned. People were working for breaking codes, or for MI5, or PAMA's sister is a double agent in Paris. But their families think that they're filing, you know, reports and getting tea. And I thought that was clever, but probably quite accurate.
Well, it was very accurate. And the sad thing to me was when they started working in these capacities, they signed the Official Secrets Act, and they said for their lifetime they would not divulge what they had been doing. And so literally this carried through to the mid-1990s when it was lifted. You know, the 50 years were up. And that actually meant that some people's parents died never knowing that their child had done something really heroic to bring the war to a close, and thinking, oh, my child, what a complete failure he was. He didn't go out to fight like everybody else. He was sitting in an office doing stupid office work. And so they could never tell their spouses or their parents, I did something really special, you know. I helped break the code that saved a whole convoy of ships. But they couldn't tell anybody that. And the other thing in my book is that these various factions, MI5, and Bletchley Park and all the different agencies didn't talk to each other because of the secrecy. And as you know, in my book, we have characters. If they'd spoken to each other at the beginning of the story, we wouldn't have had a very long story, because it was when they were working together that they suddenly thought, oh, God, we know what you were looking for.
And it was very much, what a small world it is. And I think it is a small world. I think in many cases, at least from what I've read and your book, a lot of times they went to people who were educated to do some of these tasks, and often educated people were higher class, professional class, aristocrats, who had the luxury of going to university. Ben, the other main character, is the son of the local vicar, and he went to university. He was a scholarship boy, but he went to Oxford, not Cambridge, which is MI5 boss preferred, which, of course, is a whole other thing in about 15 years with the Trinity 6, but Trinity 5, excuse me.
Yeah, well, actually, it was all... This would be an interesting thing to do in a future book, because there already were communist sympathizers who were Cambridge boys who were working during World War II. But Cambridge seemed to turn out the mathematicians who worked so well at Bletchley. There were a whole lot of them. Ben is an interesting, because he's considered upper class, because, you know, he was of the right social standing, except that his father, being a vicar, was had no money, you know, because vicars were poorly paid. They got whatever the church took in, pretty much. So he's accepted quite as an equal with Lord Westrom's family, but he can't compete in money-wise. So he's always felt all his life that, you know, he went to public school on a scholarship. He went to Oxford on a scholarship. So he's always felt that he couldn't really compete with, say, people like Jeremy, the other main character. The interesting thing about Bletchley Park is they actively recruited Debs, the daughters, debutantes, the daughters of the aristocracy, because their thought was not that they were incredibly brilliant, but more that they could be trusted to not divulge what they were doing, because they were brought up to do the right thing.
And that shows in the story, because Pama is very, very concerned that she do the right thing, and there's a lot of soul searching. She does a lot of soul searching about her tasks and what she's asked to do. But at the same time, I think she appreciates that she's able to contribute, even if she can't share exactly what she's doing with everybody. I think that's something that's brought out in a lot of fiction of the time, that women were really brought into the process.
I mean, for women, it was a huge time of opportunity, especially if you imagine these upper-class girls. They were brought up pretty much in isolation in their big houses. They were presented at court. They're supposed to marry well. And, you know, they've had a very boring life in many ways. Look at poor little Phoebe. She's bored to tears where she is. So the fact that the war came along and women suddenly could be in positions that in normal life would never have happened. My own aunt was went to work for the Admiralty, the Navy Department in England, and rose to a very senior position. You know, she was the sort of person who'd get on the phone and say, I want those 2,000 torpedoes by the end of the day. Do you understand? And they'd say, yes, ma'am. And then after the war, they said, well, I suggest you go back to the head of the Secretarial Department. And she said, no, thank you.
Good for her.
Yeah.
But you mentioned Phoebe, and I had her in a question. She may have been in for a very boring life. However, it wasn't boring. She and a young boy who's been relocated from London, from London's East End, which endured a lot of the bombing, Alfie, actually discover the body of the parachutist in the field that sets the story in motion. And they actually have a pretty exciting time of it for kids stuck in the middle
yeah,
of the country.
They were such fun characters to write about. You know, originally I was going to have the four sisters, and I thought, you know, it would be fun if you had like a junior sleuth in here who thinks she's doing a really good job at, you know, working undercover and trying. She and Alfie, what an exciting. Yes, it's become very exciting for them. Of course, in their naivete, they're going to put themselves in harm's way. But it was fun for her to, and you can see at the beginning how she's been brought up to be very patronizing to this boy from London, but in the end, he becomes a co-conspirator.
And interestingly enough, and you point this out throughout the book, the aristocracy is still the aristocracy, but it's breaking down. I mean, Phoebe has no other playmates, and there's Alfie, who couldn't be more different, and 10 years before would never think of talking to her.
Nor would she have considered talking to him, you know.
And they're friends. They become really, really good pals. And, you know, without being heavy-handed, I think this book does a really good job of showing the changes that are taking place, not just the fact that there's a really terrible, horrible war going on, but people are beginning to rethink some of their assumptions. Certainly Pama is.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I when you think of how Pama has to, and her friend Trixie, how they have to put up with awful living conditions, you know, and yet they make a joke of it, the fact that they're stuck at this awful, with this awful landlady who feeds them the most disgusting food, and yet, you know, they're in it together, and it's sort of, it's almost a joke to them. It's not, we have to get out of this and go into a decent hotel immediately. They don't think like that.
It's, you know, we have to do this and keep a stiff upper lip. And
yeah, we do, yeah.
And, like all the sign says, keep calm and carry on.
Yeah, I mean, that was so true for everybody. You know, they realized that food was rationed. Most people were very fair about it. Some people, of course, made use of the black market, and some people got rich on the black market. But most people accepted the fact that they would only get, you know, the ration at that time was a quarter of a pound of meat per week per person.
Unbelievable.
So you didn't, you know, you had to make do with potatoes and vegetables and you know, lots of stodgy pastry and you had powdered eggs and the food was quite disgusting, I'm sure. And I think it was very hard for housewives to feed their family. But in the country, you did a bit better, obviously, because, you know, places like Farley Place, they would have had enough ground to grow their own vegetables. So they would have eaten healthily, not as well as they would before. But they would have trapped, as Alfie is doing at the very beginning, trapped the odd rabbit that they would have eaten. And so they would have kept going. But in the cities, the people had a really tough time feeding their families. You could get cans of Spam. You could get cans of corned beef occasionally. So that was what they made do when you couldn't get meat in the shops.
I read somewhere that actually rabbits were not part of the meat ration. If you could trap a rabbit, you could have it.
Oh, yes, you could, yes. Although, you know, other things that you grew on farms had to be shared. Like if you had a pig farm, you probably didn't get any more of a part of the pig than other people did because it all had to be divided out fairly. But no, yeah, rabbits became, I remember at school, you know, right up into the 1950s, I remember getting rabbit stew occasionally at school. And then, of course, they introduced that disease to kill the rabbits, and after that, nobody would touch rabbit again because they didn't want diseased rabbit.
Which is, you could hardly blame them. So I kept thinking as I read this book that Pama, especially towards the end, that Pama and Ben are pretty engaging. And I was wondering if this is the birth of yet another series, which would be your fourth, I think.
Oh, God, no, please. No, the interesting thing was I wrote this book completely as a standalone, you know, and I have had so many messages already from people emailing me and posting on my Facebook page saying, well, this is going to be a series, isn't it? Like, no, it's not going to be a series. I haven't left out the possibility that I won't revisit them. As you can see in the last pages, I've opened a few doors.
Yes, you have.
I might go back and revisit the characters maybe in one more book or maybe in two more books. But I certainly wouldn't want it to be a series because the big thing with a series is it's lovely. You know the characters, but you're stuck with them and you're stuck with the environment. And I have so many more things I want to write that having the scope to do a standalone novel like this with my new publisher was lovely. It's like, I can write what I want to. This is perfect. And while I love, you know, Molly and Georgie have been an ongoing series for me, I'm up to book 17 in the Molly Murphy series now. Now, how long can she keep going? And I really enjoy writing my Royal Spinous books because they're funny and I can sit and chuckle and that's very therapeutic. But I wouldn't want to be tied to a third series when I've got other times and I've got other places I want to explore. In fact, I'm in the middle right now of writing the standalone novel for Lake Union for next year. And it's set in World War II, but it's set mainly in Tuscany. And that was lovely to do. You know, that's another area to explore.
And you take, I believe you're going to take Georgie to Tuscany for the book that's coming out this summer for the Royal Spinous book.
Not Tuscany, but Italy. She's going to Stresa on Lake Maggiore. And I decided to set it there because, you know, when I start writing a particular time, I do background reading on what was actually happening in the world at that time, because obviously it would be important to my characters. And I found that in the spring of 1935, which is where we are with Georgie at the moment, that there had been a conference in Stresa between Italy and France and England. And the conference was to discuss how to handle the Nazi threat. And I thought when I read that, this is really strange because actually Mussolini was very thick with Hitler. They were great fans of each other. And I thought there's no way that Italy and France and England would want to be combined against Germany. And I thought there must have been something underhand going on here, another conference that we don't know about. So that's when I decided to take Georgie there.
Well, I'm looking forward to that one. Like you said, she's a fun character to write, but in amongst the fun, I think you do, as you did in Farley Field, a good job of pointing out the inequities of the time. You know, you would think that being a minor royal would be a really cool thing, only for her it's not. And I think we discussed this during our last conversation when we talked about Malice at the Palace, that...
Yeah.
It's really quite constricting for her.
Yeah, and I mean, the main thing is having no money because, you know, she has no qualifications. It's pretty much the end of the Great Depression. There still aren't jobs, especially for women. So how does she support herself if her family doesn't support her? What does she do? And that's been her dilemma through all the books in this series. You know, she's tried occasionally to get odd jobs and things, but she's not qualified to have a job. And, you know, it's money has been a problem for her. She's doing a little better now, and we've got up to book 11 coming out this year, and she does know people, and she's made some good connections where people have said, come and stay with me. So, but it's not the same as having your own life and, you know, being settled in your own life. So we shall see, you know, where things take her. But at the moment, she's doing okay.
Well, and we thank you for that, and we thank you for all of these books, because you are a, as you said at the beginning of this conversation, obviously crazy, but in a really wonderful way, and in a way that entertains us and you know, engages us. And so thank you, and thank you for taking the time this morning to talk to me. I really appreciate it.
I've enjoyed it so much. I always enjoy chatting with you. We cover some really interesting topics, and I really like that. So thanks, Nancy. Well, look forward to talking to you next year about Tuscany.
Oh, absolutely. Or maybe later this summer when we talk about Her Royal Spiness. You could be a frequent contributor if you have the time.
Oh, good. Any time you may call. That's really nice. Oh, thanks so much, Nancy.